Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to Chemistry World with Victoria Gill, Richard Van Norden, Manisha Lalou, and James Mitchell Crowe. I'm Chris Smith. Coming up, why the moon's actually a much wetter place than we first thought.
We've always thought the moon is completely bone dry, and now it turns out some researchers have actually managed to find some water. They re-examined some of the soil dug up by the Apollo missions in the 1970s, and they looked at these glassy beads that are scattered all over this soil. They come in green and orange varieties, but in the middle of these beads, they did detect a small amount of water.
So no cheese then. That's on the way. Also, talking of water, we'll be finding out what ice cores from Antarctica can tell us about climate change.
We're much higher than it has been at any time in the last 800,000 years. So it ranges between 170 in the cold periods and about 300 in the very warmest periods. And right now, we're at 380 this year and rising by 2 parts per million per year.
That's Eric Wolfe from the British Antarctic Survey. He'll be joining us later when we'll also be celebrating summer with a drink.
So we're going to see if Rich can tell the difference between the beer that's been exposed to sunlight, and hopefully there's been some interesting photochemistry affecting its flavour, and the beer that's been lovingly refrigerated. So this is beer number one.
I can see you've worked in a pub, Vic. Can he have some beer with his head, please? Now, they say you shouldn't taste your chemistry experiments, but this was one exception that the team were willing to make. That's the science of beer and photochemistry, and it's coming up later, when we'll also be solving last month's chemical conundrum.
If you had a standoff between hydrogen, carbon and chlorine, which has the highest first ionisation energy?
The answer's on the way, and if you sent in a chemical solution, then stay tuned to find out if you're one of this month's winners.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Now, for anyone who is disappointed to learn as a child that the moon isn't really made of cheese, there is some consolation, because now it looks like scientists have found that, in fact, there's quite a lot of water up there, Richard.
Well, not a lot of water, Chris. We've always thought the moon is completely bone dry, and now it turns out some researchers have actually managed to find some water. They re-examined some of the soil dug up by the Apollo missions in the 1970s, and they looked at these glassy beads that are scattered all over this soil. They come in green and orange varieties, and it's the titanium and the magnesium that's causing this colour. And when they looked at these beads, there's no volatile components like water or chlorine or fluorine on the surface. As you'd expect, the moon is very small, it doesn't have an atmosphere. All of these volatile components would have floated away long ago. That's why the moon is bone dry. But in the middle of these beads, they did detect a small amount of water. And doing some modelling to work out perhaps how quickly the water diffused away from these beads, which they think were formed during volcanic eruptions. These beads are sort of melted glassy magnesium or titanium.
Were they formed in situ on the moon, or presumably they were formed on the early Earth, and then when the moon got formed from the Earth's crust, they got carried with it? Is that what happened?
Well, that's the question. That's what they don't know. They actually found, after the modelling, that the amount of water that would have been present in these beads is about the same as what's in the Earth's mantle. And that obviously gives rise to the question, did these come from the Earth in an impact? But they don't think it was a meteorite from outer space, because there doesn't seem to be things like nickel there that would have come from the meteorites as well. So now the question is, how was the water preserved in these glassy components? Did something crash in from the Earth, as you say? It's very intriguing. And they seem to have just struck lucky. They seem to have just found these beads. People have been looking at these soils for some time, and they happen to have picked some that seem to have water in. It may be that water isn't scattered all over the moon in these beads, and that they've just picked exactly the right spot.
So what's the implication of this then? Where next? What are the big questions that this has opened up?
Well, the question is, was there water on the early moon? Could it have hung around long enough for something interesting to happen? Or did it all disappear very quickly, leaving the mostly dry moon we know today? And can we find more water in other types of beads? Can we work out how the water got there, perhaps by more detailed analysis on the hydrogen and deuterium isotopes of the water? So that's still to be addressed, but it's very exciting that the moon is not really as dry as we thought.
But it does sound like it's going to necessitate a return visit to answer some of those questions.
Well, the authors from the Brown University in Rhode Island, US, say that even manned crews might not actually find water. You know, they think they were quite lucky, and so they're not even sure that manned crews will find water. But of course, we should see if China and the US's race to the moon continues at its current pace, we might see manned visits to the moon by 2020, so perhaps the mystery will be resolved.
Thanks, Richard. We're sticking with the subject of water and our near-cosmic neighbours. Scientists are working on Mars, Manisha, to understand a bit more about the surface chemistry there.
Yeah, there's been quite a lot of exciting chemistry going on Mars at the moment as a result of the Phoenix Mars lander, which touched down on the Arctic plains on the 25th of May. So over the last couple of months, the scientists have been busy carrying out chemistry experiments that can help us study the history of water on Mars and study whether Mars has the potential to support life.
What sorts of things have they been doing to answer those questions?
From a chemist's perspective, I guess there are two main experiments they've been carrying out. The first has been using the wet chemistry laboratories on Phoenix, which is part of an instrument called MECA, which is Phoenix's Microscopy Electrochemistry and Conductivity Analyzer. Basically, the wet chemistry experiments are carried out in these miniature chemistry labs, which are the size of a teacup and contain ion selective electrodes, which can measure things such as what type of ions are in the solution, and the pH of solution of soil and water, and the conductivity of soil. So far, they found out that the soil on Mars is alkaline. It's about a pH of 8 or 9. And they've also found sodium, potassium, magnesium, chloride and sulfate salts.
How do the abundances of those things compare with the same chemicals on Earth? Have we got a composition of the surface of Mars similar to Earth, or is it very dramatically different?
At the moment, they've still got a lot of analysing left to do. It'll take weeks and months before they can determine the true significance of these results. I spoke to their lead scientist called Sam Knarves, and he says they don't know the exact levels of salts and ions in the solutions at the moment, but they're somewhere in between tap water and seawater.
Sounds tasty. So they haven't actually got that long to do all this, though, have they? Because the probe can only work until winter comes, and then that's it.
Yeah, that's true. At the moment, the scientists have been working to a Mars day. They've been working to Mars time, which is a 24.7 Earth hour day. And their mission is scheduled to last for 90 sols, which is 90 Martian days. So that should end at the end of August. But the scientist I talked to said they're going to hopefully extend it for a couple of months, but they're well on track to get all the chemistry done.
And a Mars a day really does help you work, rest and play then, doesn't it?
I guess so, yeah.
Thank you to Manisha Lalou. Well, coming back to Earth now and to Antarctica, which paradoxically, despite being the coldest place on Earth, also holds many of the answers to the question of global warming. Here's Eric Wolfe.
Antarctica in various ways holds the key to understanding a lot of aspects of the Earth, especially to do with climate change. The work that I do is particularly on ice cores. And ice cores are the clearest way we have of knowing how the famous greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and methane, have changed in the past. And although we think of Antarctica as very remote, it does have a significant effect on global climate. So we do really need to understand that just as much as anywhere else in the world.
So when we're talking about the ice in Antarctica, how thick is it?
In the central parts of Antarctica, the ice can be up to 4 kilometres or 3 miles thick. Of course, around the coast, it's very much thinner, but that 4 kilometres has been snowfall falling over thousands, millions of years. Actually, the ice sheet's been there probably continuously for at least 20 million years. And so it builds up to these incredible thicknesses.
And so once you want to unlock the data that's in that ice, how do you get at it? Obviously, you've got to drill it out in some way.
So yes, we go. I have friends who are engineers who go and drill this ice for me using these. They look a little bit like very large wood boring instruments, but they drill out a cylinder of ice, maybe about 10 centimetres in diameter. You pull up 3 or 4 metres at a time, and if you keep going and do that 1,000 times, you get to the bottom of the ice sheet.
And so how far back, if you get to the bottom, that gives you how much time?
Well, the oldest ice that we've got so far from ice cores in Antarctica is 800,000 years old. We think that there is older ice somewhere, and sometime in the rest of my career, I hope that we'll get to well beyond a million years. But 800,000 years already takes us through 8 cycles of having ice ages and warmer periods. So it's already a very good range of climate.
And how do you get the data out? So once you've got the chunk of ice, how do you actually find out what the climate was doing by analysing that?
Okay, well, as you're implying, it's all chemistry. Mainly we bring the ice back. Some of the analysis is done in the field in Antarctica, but mostly it's brought back in different sections that are sent to different labs around Europe, in the case of the projects I've mostly been involved with. The first thing that we measure is the isotopic content of the water itself. So that's comparing the amount of water with oxygen with a weight of 18 and water, standard water, with oxygen with a weight of 16. And that tells you what the temperature was at the time the snow fell. So that's really the very primary thing that you want to know that keys everything else in. Then in addition, there are lots of impurities in the ice. For example, we can measure sulfuric acid or sulfate in the ice. And it tells us lots of things, but one of the very obvious things is that you occasionally see very big spikes where the concentration of sulfate goes up by maybe a factor of 3 over the background, and that's always because that was a year when there was a big volcanic eruption like Krakatoa in 1883. And then finally you've got these little bubbles of air that are trapped in the ice, and those bubbles can be cracked open again and analysed for all the trace gases in the atmosphere.
And when you do this analysis, what's the message that's emerging? What are you seeing?
Well, there are different messages depending on the timescales you look at, but the big one that comes out of the long records is that you see climate warming and cooling over 800,000 years, and the most striking thing is that carbon dioxide and methane, but carbon dioxide particularly, go up and down as the ice ages go up and down. Our inference from that, firstly, is that they're playing a major role in amplifying what should be very small climate changes into big ones that can make ice sheets come and go. Of course, it's also telling us something about the carbon cycle and about how carbon dioxide is released from the oceans and from land at different times, which is something we're going to really need to understand in the future as we want the oceans to mop up some of the carbon dioxide we're putting into the atmosphere. So it both tells us how carbon dioxide affects the climate and how the climate affects carbon dioxide.
Because some people have pointed out that we assume that the CO2 goes up and then the world warms up. But of course, when you warm the planet, you warm the sea. And if you have a warmer water, then less gas will dissolve in warmer water. And as a result, that would lead to CO2 coming out, wouldn't it? So how do we know that it's the CO2 coming first and then other effects secondarily?
Well, actually, in the past, it probably wasn't the CO2 coming first. That's a very good point and worth making. In these natural changes of several degrees Celsius in global temperature that happened roughly every 100,000 years, we think it was almost certainly small changes in the structure of the Earth's orbit around the sun that triggered everything off. But then the carbon dioxide coming out soon afterwards amplified it up to being a very big climate change. So you get this, as you say, a chicken and egg situation where both the temperature and the carbon dioxide are rising together actually for several thousand years. And the difference with what's happening now is that we don't have to say which came first because we know which came first. We know we're putting lots of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And that's another one of the very clear results from ice cores.
When we compare CO2 levels now with what your records say they have ever been in the past, where are we now on the sort of grand scheme of things?
Well, we're much higher than it has been at any time in the last 800,000 years. So it ranges between 170 in the cold periods and about 300 in the very warmest periods. And right now, we're at 380 or 385, I think, this year, and rising by 2 parts per million per year. So it's much higher than any time in that period. There are very indirect measurements from ocean sediments suggesting that carbon dioxide was significantly higher 10, 20 million years ago, and then, of course, a lot higher back in geological time when the Earth was indeed very much warmer than it is now. So within the time period when the Earth looked like it does now, with the continents in the same places, this is probably the highest level, but we only know about the last 800,000 years for sure.
Sure, but when it's gone that high before, what's actually turned things around and made it come down again? Because that's a pretty important question for us to be able to answer, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I don't think anybody has a particularly good idea. On these 100,000-year timescales, we think what's happening is essentially the balance between what's in the deep ocean, what's in the surface ocean, and what's in the atmosphere has been changing, probably due to changes in the way the ocean circulates. But over longer geological time, there's a balance between carbon dioxide being put into the atmosphere and taken out through volcanism on the one hand and weathering on the other hand. And so that's determined by things like how big an area of mountain building is going on that causes weathering and things like that, which I have to say are beyond my remit, but they're certainly on timescales that aren't going to help us.
So when it comes to global warming, it sounds like we've got something of a mountain to climb. Thank you very much. That's Eric Wolfe from the British Antarctic Survey. This is the Chemistry World podcast with me, Chris Smith, and still to come, we'll be finding out why heavy metals might be to blame for dolphins beaching themselves, and we'll also be raising a glass and drinking the contents to beer photochemistry. But first, Victoria, we've heard of people having eyes in the backs of their heads, but now there's a possibility that skin almost has eyes of its own.
Well, this is a team of researchers from the University of Paris, and they have found that proteins that are sensitive to light, very similar to the light-sensitive proteins that you find in plants that kickstart chemical reactions that tell a plant when to flower or when to unfurl its leaves, they're found in our skin. Now, we've known this for a long time, but what wasn't known was whether they were actually light-sensitive and whether they have any function.
So what are they doing in the skin? Do we know what they do there at all?
Well, we still don't know. This is very preliminary research. We still don't know quite why they're there, but this particular research group has discovered that they do respond to light, which was something that was completely unknown. So what they did was they expressed these cryptochromes. So these are light-sensitive proteins. They reduce in response to light. Or at least they do in the plant version. So they took the proteins from human skin and also the fly version of this protein and expressed them in cells. And then they exposed them to blue light, to which the plant cryptochromes are very, very sensitive, very highly sensitive. And they found, looking at them very closely with very sensitive spectroscopic techniques, they found that indeed they do change, they photoreduce, just like the plant proteins do. So what they've concluded is that there may be a function for these proteins. We may be sensing light through these proteins in our skin, and that may be contributing to, say, our circadian clock. So that's the day and night rhythm that tells us when to sleep and when to be awake.
Isn't that what eyes are for?
Well, exactly. I mean, we know that we sense light through our eyes and that we have chemical reactions that are stimulated by proteins that are found in our retinas. And we know very well that the circadian rhythms are linked very closely with those chemical reactions. So it's quite controversial. This research team haven't concluded quite what these proteins are doing when they respond to light, just that they do. And in fact, we spoke to one researcher who explained that in humans who are blind and can't sense light through their eyes at all, those people don't have any body clock, so they don't have a circadian rhythm. So we can only sense light through our eyes, is what he was telling us. So it seems that we still haven't determined what the function of these skin cryptochromes is.
There was a paper in Science a few years back where they were experimenting with the idea of shining lights into the backs of people's knees on aeroplanes to try to reset the body clock so they wouldn't get jet lag. And in fact, it was found to be rubbish. And
right.
There is no evidence that light shone on the skin can adjust the body clock, even though it was a paper in Science to start with. It was subsequently disproved. So it sounds like this agrees with what your researcher told you.
Yeah, exactly. And it still leaves these light-sensitive proteins, they're a bit mysterious.
Well, let's hope someone can shed some light on that dark mystery before too long. Thank you, Victoria. Well, from a heavy question about light to a heavy question about heavy metals, because there's a suggestion, James, that this might be the reason that some animals like dolphins choose to beach themselves.
Well, some Australian scientists have been looking at the connection between mercury poisoning and dolphins beaching themselves. So a group at Monash University in Melbourne have looked at a local pod of dolphins in Port Phillip Bay, just outside of the city of Melbourne, and measured the mercury levels of healthy dolphins, or apparently healthy dolphins, swimming around in the bay, and compared their levels with the dolphins who have beached themselves and subsequently died, and have found that the beached dolphins have average mercury levels over twice that of the healthy dolphins.
Is that throughout their body, or are there any particular hotspots, like the brain, for example? Is this sort of a neurological effect?
Yes, the levels detected would definitely have a neurological effect, which would likely induce confusion and disorientation. So could potentially be directly leading them to beach themselves.
So this is a sort of dolphin equivalent of the Mad Hatter syndrome.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. In the particular area that these guys have been researching in Port Phillip Bay, there's a lot of dredging work going on at the moment in the port, which is sort of stirring up the sediment and potentially increasing the mercury levels in the water. The team suggests that the likely source of the mercury was the historical gold mines dotted throughout Victoria, which have gradually washed down the rivers, ended up in the bay, in the sediments, and eventually, through the fish that the dolphins eat, accumulate in the dolphins. The team are going to go on and look at historical mercury levels and try and establish whether this is an increasing problem. So the next step that these guys are going to take is to take teeth from dolphin samples in museums, check the mercury levels there. The other benefit of using teeth is that you know exactly how old the dolphin is, so you can determine how much mercury it's accumulated over its lifetime to try and establish whether the mercury levels are increasing.
Well, let's hope not. Thanks, James. Now, as he put it to me, almost every scientist likes beer, which is partly why he became interested in studying it and how sunlight can affect the way it tastes. Here's Malcolm Forbes.
I have a special technique I've developed in my lab called time-resolved electron paramagnetic resonance spectroscopy, and it looks at fast photochemical reactions on the sub-microsecond timescale that allows you to look at the structure of a free radical and deduce its structure, look at its reactivity, maybe some of its molecular dynamics.
And what do you think is going on when beer changes flavor in this way?
Well, what we believe happens is the hop compounds, they're called the isohumulones, these are the compounds that give beer its bitter flavor, they absorb light, and once they absorb light, they're in a very high energy state, and they break apart, and they break apart in something called free radicals, which people have heard of in the cosmetics industry. They're responsible for wrinkles, for example, and aging. Free radicals are a big part of the aging process. But these radicals in beer are trapped almost immediately by sulfur sources in the beer, and they make compounds called thiols, and thiols are an extremely stinky compound. They're found in skunks, they're found in cat urine. Almost anything that smells really bad has thiols in it, and humans are very sensitive to these smells. So we wanted to find out what radicals exactly were being trapped by these sulfur compounds and were creating these bad smells.
And so what did you do?
Well, Dennis, my collaborator at the University of Ghent, sent us different types of hop compounds, some of that were of the natural variety, some that were chemically modified a little bit, that the brewing industry uses to combat this problem. And we put them in our spectrometer. We shined ultraviolet light laser pulses on them. We created free radicals, and we trapped these signals in real time. And we determined their structure. And we were able to say, yes, indeed, hop compounds produce free radicals. These are the radicals that are formed. And this leads directly to an understanding of the mechanism of the formation of skunky beer.
So now you know this, are we, and this is the million-dollar question, are we any closer to being able to stop it so that we don't have to put up with nasty-smelling and nasty-tasting beer?
Yes, and I think that the answer is in natural additives to beer that can absorb the light before it reaches the hop compounds. So what you need is a compound that will have a very easy way to absorb the light and then dissipate the energy in some other way than giving it to the hop compounds. And there are such additives. These are heavily guarded trade secrets in the brewing industry. The company that funded this research, the Interbrew Latour Foundation, and they are sponsored by Interbrew, and they actually benefit from this because now there are beers that are sold in clear bottles, and they are not as light sensitive as other beers, and so they have a much longer shelf life, and they don't get bad in the sun. When you open the beer, it will last a much longer time in the sun.
So this is almost like sun cream for beer, isn't it? Do you see the same chemistry happening in other things, not just beer? There must be other things like the way the hops are behaving in other foodstuffs, which is also going to make things taste bad.
Yes, and in fact, any time you have a natural foodstuff, the sources of sulfur are usually amino acids like cysteine. And so whenever you have a compound that makes free radicals in the sun, and it's near these natural products that contain cysteine, you're likely to get these thiols. And I would say that almost any natural foodstuff, if it's left out in the sun, if the light doesn't get it, certainly oxygen will, and free radicals are always responsible for this degradation, this bad taste. There are pharmaceuticals that go bad in the sun very quickly, that people tell you not to keep your medication out in the sun, not to expose it to too much light, because it can degrade very quickly.
Professor Malcolm Forbes, who is from the University of North Carolina. Right, well, we've come outside now, partly because it's pretty unusual in this country to have a summer's evening where it's nice enough where we can get outside, but also to test out some of Malcolm's science for ourselves, and also to have a major session by the look of it, because, Victoria, you have covered my table with beer bottles, so what are we going to do?
It's all, I promise you, in the name of chemistry. We're doing an experiment in beer photochemistry. We have two bottles on the table at the moment of beer encased in colourless glass. Now, that's important because we have taken one of those bottles and left it on a sunny windowsill for 12 hours of sunshine. And the other one we have kept in its packaging and put it in the fridge. So we've got one beer exposed to light and one not.
And for our Australian listeners, I should reassure you, this is nice warm beer at room temperature.
It is. It's been under my desk all day, so it is at perfect room temperature. So we're going to see if Rich can tell the difference between the beer that's been exposed to sunlight, and hopefully there's been some interesting photochemistry affecting its flavour, and the beer that's been lovingly refrigerated.
So we're going to ask Richard to taste this. So let's pour Richard a beer. Save some for me.
Okay, so this is beer number one.
I can see you've worked in a pub, Vic. can he have some beer with his head, please?
Yeah, we'll just wait for that to shrink a little bit.
We could be waiting some time. Should we pour the other one out as well?
Yeah.
Just while that one, settles,
while that one settles
the 5 feet of head it now has. Oh, that's a bit better. Okay, so Richard doesn't know which one is which.
Right, that's right, I hope. Okay, so we'll try you on this one first. This is beer B.
Okay, Richard, are you ready?
I'm ready.
It might taste awful. I don't know.
I don't know. Well, it's Corona anyway, isn't it? So. Well, it's so difficult. I'm so unused to having it without the lime. It tastes a little odd. I'll tell you which one's off when I've tasted both.
So, beer A, it's now finally settled, so you can have the one you were supposed to have first, second.
Right, here we go. I would have to say that beer B, the one I tasted first, did taste a little weird compared to my normal Corona experience.
Just to say, I did wash the glass before he tried it. He's actually effectively got that right, because your beer B is the one which you've got a big red do not drink sign on the bottle, actually. So what's this all about?
So, yes, he's quite right. Beer B is the one that should taste weird, and it's known as skunked because it has a it has a compound in that's lovingly referred to as skunky thiol. Now, what's happened here is...
Nothing to do with cannabis.
No, quite different. This is about alpha acids that are hop-derived compounds that are in the beer. And when light hits the beer, it starts a chemical reaction between these alpha acids and other molecules that would otherwise just remain in your beer and cause no harm to the beer's flavour. So these photosensitive molecules that kickstart this reaction are called flavins. Now these flavins, when they're excited by light, they cleave off a side chain of these alpha acids. And then these side chains are quite reactive compounds. So they go on and react with sulfur sources in the beer to form what's called 3-methylbute-2-ene-1-thiol, or MBT.
Easy for you to say.
Indeed. But it's...
more so after you've had a few...
More commonly referred to as skunky thiol. Now, it's very chemically similar to the compound that skunks emit when they're frightened. I've never actually smelled that in my life, but I am told by Malcolm Forbes, professor of chemistry at the University of North Carolina, that this skunky thiol is in fact the exact same compound that gives cat urine its distinctive aroma.
So could this be when we say that beer tastes like piss? Actually, that there is a real chemical basis for saying that.
Yes, exactly. That's chemically very accurate.
Thank you very much, Vic. Well, there you have it. I'll drink the rest of the one that isn't marked with the red do not drink sign in a minute. Talking about asking people things, we've got a chemical conundrum from last month, Richard.
Yeah, last month, you'll remember, we offered you our set of exclusive RSC visual elements trumps for anyone who could answer the following question. If you had a standoff between hydrogen, carbon and chlorine, which one has the highest first ionisation energy?
And the answer we were looking for is hydrogen. Congratulations to our six winners, Liam O'Donnell, Christine Monsell, Nick Lakin, Ali Akbar, Victoria Blair and Peter Wesson.
So well done to all of you. What about next month, Richard?
Well, of course, we're looking forward to the Olympics this month. So we have a chemistry angle on this fantastic sporting event in Beijing. We'd like to know which world-renowned chemist synthesised the molecular version of the Olympic rings. And you can check our blog for the structure of that, which is quite amazing. So email us your answers, chemistryworld@rsc.org. Don't forget to give us your name and address so that we can send you your prize if you win.
And if someone does email that address with the right answer, what are they going to win?
We've actually got a bit of an exclusive prize this month. We've got
some skunk. skunky beer?
No, we're not giving away beer. We just don't have the postal allowance to be able to wrap it up and post it. But yeah, we have five exclusive signed copies of John Emsley's new book, Molecules of Murder, which is being published by the RSC this month.
And most people would kill to get their hands on a copy of that, it has to be said. John Emsley, brilliant writer. OK, well, that's it for this month's Chemistry World podcast. We're back next month with another fun instalment of what's happening in the world of chemistry. If you'd like to drop us a line and give us any feedback about this or one of our previous programmes, then you can write to that address. It's chemistryworld@rsc.org. In the meantime, thank you very much to this month's contributors, Victoria Gill, Manisha Lelou, James Mitchell Crowe and Richard Van Norden. The production was by Meera Senthilingam. I'm Chris Smith and we're from thenakedscientist.com. Have a great month. And see you next time. Right now, I've got some drinking to do. Cheers, everyone.
Cheers. Cheers.